and warm, a high of 83 inland, 78 near Lake Michigan. Here are the numbers now. Humidity at 78%, wind southeast at 10. Sunshine was 73 in Kenosha, 71 in Racine, 68 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
In this interview, we are going to be taken back to one of the most decisive moments in World War II in the Pacific Theater. A decisive battle that turned the tide of the war in an extraordinary fashion. Although at this point in time, in late 1944, the writing was already on the wall for Japan. But nevertheless, they engaged in what was, in many respects, a battle born of desperation, Leyte Gulf. And the book about it is called Leyte Gulf, A New History of the World's Largest Sea Battle. This is a battle that the author of this book, Mark Stille, tells us was has no counterpart. The most complex naval battle of the entire Second World War. And in many respects, in terms of its sheer size and scope, it may be unprecedented in all of world history, and it is no small feat to make sense of it, and in particular to dispel certain myths that have surrounded it. Mark Stille is certainly the man equipped for the job. He has written extensively on naval history in the Pacific and is a retired commander from the U.S. Navy, spending almost four decades doing intelligence work, including time as a faculty member at the Naval War College. He has a number of books to his credit, and this is just the latest, published by Osprey Publishing, again titled Leyte, A New History of the World's Largest Sea Battle. And Mark Stille, we welcome you to the morning show.
Great, Greg. Thanks. It's good to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I want to begin with a couple of kind of general questions about the challenge of writing about something like this. I mean, particularly this battle, which was so large and so complex, but even about writing about battles of a more limited, modest scope, it seems to me that by its very nature, battle is just one of those kind of complicated, unfortunate human enterprises in which it is not easy to even know in the moment, let alone even after the fact, exactly what happened and what. I mean, kind of the chaos that is part of any warfare, especially warfare fought so savagely in the Pacific Theater, it just seems like that simple matter of getting the facts and then interpreting them correctly is no small matter. Quite apart from the specifics of this battle, which we'll get into later, I wonder if you could just talk more generally about the challenge that you and others face of making sense of battles, and particularly when they are as large and complicated as this one.
Yeah, it is rather difficult, even though it's been, 70 or 80 years after the battle was fought. But unless it's a well-known battle in the war, for example, in the Pacific Wars, say Midway or maybe Pearl Harbor, even Guadalcanal, it doesn't really get a lot. It has not been deeply studied. And, of course, you have the problem, the big problem, that most American authors have no access to Japanese sources. So it's really hard to write a battle when you really can't dive deep into what one side is doing. So I found that in doing Leyte Gulf, there were still a lot of minor mysteries in the battle. What happened to a certain ship at a certain time, and how did it sink? I mean, there were still mythologies, big and small, that were alive and well even at this point. And I tried to address those. There has been a lot of scholarship, over the span of these 70 or 80 years, but it's it hasn't been pulled together yet in one place, and that's what I try to do on this LaTeX book.
Right.
And I also I try to dive deep and as best I could into the Japanese side of the battle, which was hard because though the Japanese have published an extensive array of what would be considered their official history of the war, there's only been three of those translated. So I didn't have access to those, but I had to dive into other sources to make up the Japanese side of the battle.
I want to ask you about specifically the matter of writing about both sides of this conflict. I mean, the Americans and the Japanese. And one of the things that I find striking in this book and in others that you have written is the even-handedness and fairness with which you write this. I mean, you being a proud American and a veteran of the U.S. Navy, nevertheless, this is not a book that, in a sense, whitewashes mistakes that were made by the Americans, nor in any way does it, of course, demonize the Japanese, nor diminish their valor in the midst of what was, of course, ultimately a lost cause. But I'm sure maybe ahead of this, books have been written that were, in a sense, much more sort of staunchly pro-American, if you know what I mean. And I really appreciate the fact that you write with such honesty and discernment and with respect extended to both sides of this hard-fought battle. Could you just comment on that and to what extent that was a very conscious decision on your part versus just something that just was inevitable that is the way you would approach this?
Well, first, thank you very much for those comments. I do try to be objective to both sides. And to me, that's what history is all about. You cannot whitewash one side and condemn the other for the many mistakes they may have made. Like, for example, there has been a lot of whitewashing in the battle of Leyte Gulf. For example, the Battle of Samar, the famous battle where the American escort carriers were caught off guard by a large Japanese force. And the battle is often portrayed as a David and Goliath battle between American destroyers and Japanese battleships, and that's just not the way it happens. I think that's largely due to this hyper act of American patriotism to paint us in a more heroic light. I mean, there's no need to do that. It was a very heroic battle on both sides. There's no need to embellish. So to me, that's what history is all about. And you can't really write a battle, I don't think, with a series of personal accounts that you try to weave together to tell the story. You have to do some analysis of the battle and really get into it and tell the reader why each side did what they did and how well they were in their attempts to do it.
I wonder if you could talk for a moment about the general state of affairs in terms of the Pacific Theater earlier in 1944. And, of course, one of the things that's really kind of amazing is when one thinks about the disaster at Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, and then here we are with this battle in October of 1944 with already the tide turning so decisively against the Japanese. I mean, even before this particular battle is fought. Can you help us set the stage in terms of the state of affairs in terms of Japan versus America in this Pacific Theater earlier in 1944? Where were we at the time that the plans for this particular battle began to take shape?
Yeah, I'll be happy to give that a shot, but I think you did a very good job of that in your intro, your very well-done intro. But by 1944, as you say, the tide of war had turned against the Japanese, and it turned against them in a very decisive way. So in the middle of the year, in June 1944, there was a major battle fought in the Philippine Sea when the Americans invaded the Marianas Islands. So the Japanese attempted to fight a decisive battle, as they called it, to defeat this American attack, because once the Americans did seize the Marianas, they would be within long-range bomber range of the Japanese homeland. So the Japanese did everything they could to prevent that, and the Imperial Navy committed their carrier force for the first time in about a year and a half, but they were crushed by the American Navy in June 1944. And that set the stage for what was to follow a few months later when the Americans invaded the Philippines. The Americans had some debate in their higher command echelons what to do next as they advanced into the Western Pacific. The Navy wanted to essentially bypass the Philippines and invade Formosa with the goal of cutting off the Japanese supply lines from the home islands down to the resource areas in Southeast Asia. But MacArthur did not see it that way. He had a different plan. It was driven to a large degree by his personal agenda, but in the end it was the better plan. And that plan was to land in the central Philippines, and that turned out to be Leyte, and from there build their bases and eventually seize Luzon. That's the biggest island in the Philippines. And that would also cut the supply lines between Japan and Southeast Asia. So the Americans intended to do this in November, but they did speed it up. They accelerated their advance, and the final plan was to land in Leyte, in the central Philippines, in mid-October 1944.
Before we dig into that in more detail, I wonder if you could just tell us a little more about the decline of Japanese success in the Pacific Theater between 1941 and 1944, and in a sense, what the most significant factors were. What prevented them from being able to sustain their earlier defeats? I know that one of the issues, which is brought up in your book time and time again, and you just made mention of it, is that whole matter of supply lines and being able to provide, in a sense, all of the stuff of making war. It sounds like that became very seriously compromised for the Japanese even before some of what of these events took place. What else do we point to in terms of Japan, the decline of Japanese fortunes in the Pacific Theater?
We've got to start out with the entire Japanese war plan at the start of the war. They went to war with essentially a very fatuous idea of how to defeat the United States. So Pearl Harbor, as you mentioned, that was the opening blow. That was, on balance, a quite unsuccessful operation. And that's not the subject of this book. It will be the next book that I'm going to be doing. But Pearl Harbor was not successful. It only inflamed the Americans to avenge the defeat and to seek a total victory and not a negotiated peace. And that was the basic premise that the Japanese had going into the war, that they could seize the areas they needed to secure the resource areas and their supply lines back to Japan, and then defend us against the Americans, and the Americans would eventually get tired of beating their heads against the wall, and they would go to the table, and they would make a negotiated peace with the Japanese. And that's obviously not what happened. And the Imperial Navy was set up for a short war. At the start of the war, it was the most powerful navy in the Pacific, because the U.S. Navy was stretched between two oceans, the Pacific and the Atlantic, so they could not mass the entire fleet in the Pacific. So the Japanese had the advantage early on, and for the most part, they were better trained than the Americans. They had trained much harder between the wars, and that showed in the first few months of the war. Also, they had the advantage of a much more powerful and concentrated naval air force in the shape of their carrier force, which had done that Pearl Harbor attack. But over time, this force began to be attrited, and the Japanese could not replace it. It started at Midway, but the real turning point for the Imperial Navy was the Guadalcanal campaign, which went on for 6 months between the middle of 1942 to the first couple of months of 1943. And that's when they took very heavy losses, especially in their well-trained but irreplaceable naval air arm, air crews of their air arm. So that's when the fortunes of the Imperial Navy began to wane. And they really hadn't recovered from that. They tried to fight the battle we mentioned off the Marianas in mid-1944. That didn't go well. So by 1944, they really didn't have any good options. And we're going to talk about the Japanese plan later, I'm sure. And we're going to condemn it for not being well thought out. But in actuality, there weren't many good options for the Japanese by this point in the war, because they simply lacked the means to compete with the U.S. in a prolonged battle, in a prolonged war.
Absolutely. They had to hope that what happened at Pearl Harbor would leave us curled in a ball, retreating, and instead, of course, they had poked the beast, which responded angrily and with ultimately full force, and we all know how that played out.
Yeah, and they poked the beast and got nothing for it. So on the strategic level, it was a disaster, as we just talked about, because it poked the beast and made the Americans quite determined to avenge this defeat. On the operational level, they gained little as well. The American carriers weren't there, so they were not taken out of the American order of battle, and the Japanese struck the battleships that were there. And as Pearl Harbor itself showed, this was not going to be a battleship war. So it didn't matter what they sank in Pearl Harbor. And all but three of the ships that they damaged or sunk came back into operation. And even had they sunk every ship present in Pearl Harbor, it wouldn't have changed the outcome of the war anyhow. So Pearl Harbor was extremely poorly fought out by the Japanese.
Hmm. We're speaking with Mark Stille about his latest book, Leyte Gulf, A New History of the World's Largest Sea Battle. This concerns a battle that was waged over the course of late October 1944, October 23rd to October 26th, as U.S. forces returned to the Philippines. It actually involved four major engagements, and Mark Stille's book examines this long, complex battle in very, very careful fashion, looking at both sides of the conflict. Real quick, I want to talk about something that you spend a little bit of time talking about in your book, which is namely a battle that occurred not too long before Leyte Gulf, which was an attack on Formosa, we now call Taiwan, which was a very significant Japanese defeat. And you tell us it had immense implications for the Battle of Leyte Gulf. Tell us quickly about this battle, this earlier battle, and those immense implications for the major battle which you examine in your new book.
Yeah, that was a very important battle, and it's practically unknown to most people. At that point in history, it was the largest ever air-naval battle, so it was a big deal. And this was a battle prompted when Admiral Halsey, who commanded the Third Fleet, the Third Fleet was the U.S. Navy's carrier strike force, so Halsey was charged to reduce Japanese air strength before the American invasion of Leyte. So he was doing this only about the week before the invasion was going to take place. So he strikes Formosa, which was a major staging point between Japan and the Philippines, and at this point, he has, I think it was 17 or 18 carriers in the fleet. It's an immense force. He's able to send 1,400 sorties a day at the airfields in Formosa. So the Japanese saw an opportunity to hit the Third Fleet and put the American timetable for the invasion back. So the gentleman in charge of the combined fleet, that's the combat, component of the Imperial Japanese Navy, he sees an opportunity. This guy is named Admiral Toyota, and he decides he's going to commit everything he has in the way of air power to strike the Third Fleet and hopefully render it ineffective, at least for a while. So he gathers aircraft from all over, from the Philippines, from China, from Formosa, from Japan, with the hopes of massing this large force on the Americans and inflicting heavy losses on Halsey's fleet. And that's not quite how it turned out. There were a lot of Japanese aircraft involved in the battle, but a lot of these never were massed effectively. So they only, even though they had something in the area of 1,400 aircraft from all sources, only about 760 offensive sorties were flown by the Japanese, and these were ineffective. The Japanese air crews, as we already mentioned, by this point in the war, they had taken heavy losses, and the air crews at this point in the war were very poorly trained, and they were slaughtered, just like they were in June 1944 at the Battle of Philippine Sea. They fared quite poorly. So the Japanese admitted they lost 500 aircraft, and they inflicted no losses on the Americans. They did torpedo two cruisers, but they failed to hit a single aircraft carrier. So in the week before the battle, the only hope the Japanese have, since they don't have an effective carrier force at this point, the only hope they have is to mass land-based air power effectively. And they tried to do this off Formosa, and it didn't work. So based on that, it was rather obvious what was going to happen a week later when the battle kicked off.
Mm-hmm. So as we set the stage for this this gigantic battle in which the Americans and Japan engaged, known as the Battle of Leyte Gulf, there are two sides to think about, and the way in which this was approached. And it's interesting, this ends up being a battle in which some specific individuals play a very crucial role. And on the American side, we're talking about kind of a complicated setup that I think you would say was a bit misguided, kind of a division of command, kind of a complicated command structure, which, among other things, prevented really smooth and effective communication between certain key participants. And it feels like a recipe for disaster. And it sounds like it's a good thing that the odds were stacked in our favor at the outset, or this maybe could have played out a bit differently. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about, this complicated command structure, particularly between General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz, and some of the difficulties which this ultimately created.
That's a very good point. And as you mentioned, there was a divided command structure, and usually that's one of the worst things you can do in this kind of operation, this kind of large operational level battle you're getting ready to fight. But it was unavoidable because the Philippines were in MacArthur's Southwest Pacific area. So there were two theaters in the Pacific, one commanded by MacArthur in the Southwest Pacific, which included the Philippines. And then there's essentially the rest of the Pacific, which was commanded by Admiral Chester Nimitz. So in order to invade the Philippines, you had to commit the U.S. Navy's most powerful forces to cover the invasion. So these came from Admiral Nimitz. And there's no way that Nimitz was going to send his carrier force, the Third Fleet, to be under the direct command of MacArthur. That was not going to happen. But yet the battle's being fought in MacArthur's theater. So you have this this divided command structure where MacArthur has his own navy. It's the 7th Fleet under an admiral named Thomas Kincaid. And Nimitz had reinforced Kincaid's fleet extensively for this battle. But Kincaid, Norman MacArthur, did not have control of the 3rd Fleet. That was still under the command of Nimitz. So, and also MacArthur insisted that there would be no direct communications between Kincaid and Halsey. So that made it hard to fight a battle when it came down to it, when you had to take rapid decisions and communicate, you know, quickly and effectively. That did not happen when it really mattered during this battle.
Right. I wonder if you could explain what the possible motivation could be for General MacArthur to kind of insist upon that lack of direct communication. I mean, what was he afraid of, or what was the point of preventing that communication from occurring?
Well, it was within his rights to demand this, because he was afraid essentially that the Navy would conduct operations without keeping his best interest in mind. So if the 7th Fleet is under his command, he has to be aware of everything it's doing, and it cannot communicate directly and plan operations without his knowledge and even approval. Even though he did not meddle in naval affairs, to be fair to MacArthur, he wasn't a meddler in naval affairs. But it was within his right to do this. But it did make things difficult, like we just mentioned, when you had to react to Japanese moves.
Hmm. So, at one point, you mentioned something called, I think, the Fox schedule. I think it had something to do with the means by which communication took place. And it sounds like it was laborious and did not work all that well, and kind of got overwhelmed by kind of the sheer volume. Can you tell us a little more about how communication ultimately did occur, and to what extent that probably hindered the Americans to some extent?
To communicate with far-flung naval forces, like you were talking about here in Pacific, you do it on a certain broadcast schedule, and each fleet has its own broadcast schedule where you just, all the units attached to that fleet can copy that schedule and receive orders that are meant for them. So both fleets had that, but it was difficult for the 7th Fleet to communicate with the 3rd Fleet, because it had to go through the 7th Fleet communication station and out from there to 3rd Fleet. So it was a very laborious process, and it was time-consuming. And when forces are engaged, they send out many messages, and everything, human nature being what it is, my message is very important, therefore it must be given the highest priority. And that's when the communication centers got swamped. So at a point in the battle, Kincaid was actually reduced to sending out messages in the clear, uncoded, in the clear, to Halsey. That's how bad things got.
Wow. And it's so interesting. I think a lot of times when we amateurs think about this kind of warfare, it's really easy to jump to the conclusion that, in a sense, it's all about the guns, it's all about the bombs, it's all about the firepower. And I think most of us do not really understand at all the importance of what we might call the underlying infrastructure. Things like communication and supply lines and so on, that are in many respects absolutely essential to the effort. And again, we as Americans are fortunate that this situation involving poor communication didn't have more serious ramifications than it did.
And along those same lines, another important point that's often overlooked is naval logistics. People have to remember that fleets run on oil, and they take a lot of oil to move fleets any distance. These ships consume thousands of tons of oil in a day. A fleet might consume that much in a day. So that was a big problem for both sides, but the Japanese side especially. And it affected the very way the Japanese planned the battle and fought the battle, because they had to move their main fleet, which was based in Singapore, to Leyte. And that didn't seem like it's that far, but it's over 1,100 nautical miles. and the Japanese didn't have, at this point, they had plenty of fuel in that area, in the Southeast Asian area, because it was refined down there and pumped out of the ground down there, but they couldn't move it around well. They had very few tankers. So, example of how important this was, the Japanese, first of all, they were at the very edge of what they could do, moving their surface fleet from Singapore to Leyte. That was the operational range of the entire fleet. They couldn't go any further than that. And as the battle developed, they failed to get fuel in time to where it had to be to refuel the fleet on its way to Leyte. And that meant that the fleet couldn't get there until 5 days after the American invasion took place. And as we'll discuss, that was a fatal flaw with the entire plan.
Mm. We're speaking with Mark Stille and talking about his most recent book, which is called Leyte Gulf, A New History of the World's Largest Sea Battle. This was a battle fought between America and Japan over the course of 3 days in October of 1944, as U.S. forces returned to the Philippines in very decisive factor. So we need to talk about Japan at this point, what they were poised to attempt to do in terms of turning back this American invasion. And although the sort of the main Japanese leader at this point is Vice Admiral Kurito Takeo, he is actually executing a plan by Admiral Toyoda Soemu. And you spend some time in the book talking about this plan and, in a sense, taking it apart and helping us understand, in a sense, what this plan was really all about. And among other things, you tell us that this plan was not a serious plan for victory. If it was not that, what was this plan all about?
I find the Japanese plan probably the most fascinating part of the entire battle. It's just compelling to see how the Japanese thought about this battle. It's totally different than Americans would think about this kind of battle if they were in the same situation. And it also, it literally set up how the battle unfolded over the span of 3 days when it was fought. But as you just mentioned, the Japanese really didn't see this. Well, that's to be fair. They, like we mentioned before, they didn't have a lot of good options by this point in the war. But this plan was born of desperation. The Admiral Toyoda was in a use-or-lose mentality. He knew that the Americans were trying to cut the sea lanes between Japan and the resource areas. So in his mind, if that happened, the Japanese fleet, which was in the Singapore area, would be cut off and would die in the vine. So it was a plan born of desperation. And while they were planning this battle with the Imperial Army, the Imperial Army and Imperial Navy did not usually function well together. But during the planning process, the Imperial Navy planners mentioned to their Army counterparts, yes, this is a plan of desperation, and it'll allow the combined fleet a fitting end. It'll allow us to die fighting. What they didn't want to have happen was have the fleet surrender as the nation went down in defeat, like the Imperial German Navy did in World War One, and the Italian Navy just surrendered in late 1943. So that would be the worst possible outcome of the war. So this battle was, yes, they were trying to turn the tables on the Americans, but it also provided a fitting end for the Imperial fleet. We can go through it in detail if you would like, but that needs to be kept in mind, that this was a plan of desperation. And if the fleet was lost in the process, so be it. It's better than the fleet not being used and being cut off and having to surrender, perhaps, in a worst-case scenario after Japan is defeated.
Right. You write at one point, the the planning basis for this plan. And what was it called again? Shogo? Something like that?
Shogo.
Yeah.
That means a victory plan.
Yes. And that's ironic, isn't it?
Victory operation.
Right. Yeah. You're right. The planning basis for Shogo was complete and utter desperation, not the best ingredient for success. If I remember correctly, by the end of the book, as you are kind of summarizing the Battle of Leyte and the specifics, I'm pretty sure you use really strong language and call this plan an exercise in total stupidity. Am I remembering that correctly?
That sounds like the bottom line. I mean, we have to be fair to what it really was. It had no chance for success, and we should go through all the factors that led to that harsh evaluation. It's a plan of desperation. They did have other alternatives, and that's also covered in the book. If you have no chance for victory and sheer desperation is driving your planning, you should probably step back and think of something else, perhaps, you know, very much different. And they did have that option, but they did not use it because they didn't want to. This was going to give them the fitting in they wanted. But there were a lot of problems with the plan. The first one we touched upon already. The stated goal of the plan was to stop the American invasion of Leyte. That was the objective of the plan. And that meant that they had to defeat the assault force, hopefully, ideally, before it got ashore in Leyte. So the Americans land on Leyte on 20 October. And we've already said that due to a lot of problems, and the foremost being sloppy staff work, the main Japanese fleet can't get there to Leyte until 25 October. Well, right there, that just shows you the plan is ill-conceived because it cannot achieve its stated objective. By 25 October, the Americans have already put a large invasion force on Leyte. They have 132,000 men. They have over 200,000 tons of supply on the island. So the invasion is a fact by the time the Japanese can show up on 25 October. So you've already... plan has already failed at that point. Also, we talked about the imbalance of forces at this point in the war, that this was a Japanese attempt to fight a decisive battle, and that notion is embedded deep in Japanese Navy DNA. It had worked successfully against the Russians in 1905, therefore it would work against the Americans. So that's what they tried to do. Essentially, at Pearl Harbor, they tried it Midway, they tried it at the Battle of Philippine Sea, and now they're going to try it again at Leyte Gulf. And given the imbalance of forces, there was no possibility they were going to achieve a decisive battle. Mm. So they couldn't do that, they couldn't stop the invasion, and the actual mechanics of the plan were also flawed.
Mm. That's probably better explored as people read your book and can really dig into the specifics of that. I think worth mentioning also here is another factor that apparently was not sufficiently weighed by the Japanese, and that was their ill-preparedness in terms of training, that they were not in a position to wage this battle properly, in part because so many of their men lacked full and complete training. Can you talk more about that and what kind of a factor that ultimately was in all of this?
The Japanese took training very seriously, like we've already touched upon, but they had to expand the fleet just like the Americans did. Their fleet expanded greatly during the war, and they really couldn't maintain the high quality they had at the start of the war. And this pertained, for the most part, to the naval air arm, where it was extremely difficult to keep up with losses. And that's why the Japanese naval air arm was so poorly trained and why it performed so badly at Formosa the week before the battle and during the battle itself. But to be fair to the Japanese, they still had a highly trained surface fleet. But a surface fleet, you know, at this point in the war, operating without air cover was not going to get the job done. So they trained hard in the months and weeks before the battle to get their surface fleet ready for combat, but that just wasn't going to be enough.
Hmm. There are a couple of specific matters that, as our time winds down, that maybe we can just touch on, and we'll leave it to our listeners to explore this more thoroughly by reading your book. Of these four engagements that ultimately comprise the Battle of Leyte Gulf, it is the engagement that's known as the Battle off of Samar. We've briefly mentioned it already, was particularly significant. And you actually tell us it was unlike any other battle fought in naval history. Briefly, I'm afraid, explain kind of the unprecedented nature of this battle off of Samar. What made it so out of the ordinary?
So the Battle of Samar was the pivotal moment in the battle because it led to Kurita's decision to not go into the Gulf, and it also led eventually to Halsey's decision to go north against the Japanese decoy force. So this battle was different because here we have the main Japanese force under Kurita, you mentioned him earlier, with four battleships, six heavy cruisers, two light cruisers, and I think 11 destroyers. So it's a very strong and very powerful force. So it burst into the Philippine Sea through the San Bernardino Strait, and it starts to head south towards Leyte Gulf. And at that point, it looks like the Japanese are going to realize their goal of getting this large surface force into Leyte Gulf where it can shoot up the American invasion fleet. But in the way, there's this American escort carrier force known as Taffy 3. It has six escort carriers and three destroyers and four destroyer escorts. So these carriers are built on merchant ship hulls, so they're slow, they're unarmored, and they're weakly armed. So that force can't stand up against a heavy Japanese battleship-led force, or so the thinking goes. But it wasn't a battle like you see portrayed in almost all the accounts of the battle as a brave fight between American destroyers and the Japanese battleships. It was actually the only time in history that a surface force attacked a carrier force while the carrier force was launching airstrikes against the surface force. So it wasn't a surface battle. It was a very complex air-sea battle that the Japanese didn't understand from the very start.
Wow. That's really crucial in understanding all of this and also why that turned out the way that it did. Your book also takes quite a long time exploring the whole matter of Admiral Halsey, commander of the Third Fleet, taking his forces to attack the carriers of Admiral Ozawa, and that was kind of a deep decoy plan, and you try to help us kind of understand why Halsey made that decision. It sounds like that's one of the most controversial points of this whole battle, that was a kind of a reckless or stupid mistake that he made, when in fact you believe that he was acting properly with the information that he had available to him.
That's the point of the book, yes, that given what he knew at the time, that he made the correct decision. Now, of course, when you read an American account of the battle, they're usually American-centric, obviously, and therefore the pivotal point of the battle is this Halsey decision to head north and attack this decoy fleet. And that was a clever aspect of the Shogo plan, this diversion that the Japanese were going to attempt with what was left of their carrier fleet to the north, hopefully drawing Halsey up there so the Kurita force could get through San Bernardino Strait, and then head into the Gulf. So to give Japanese full credit, that was their raw scheme, and it did work to an extent. And it worked because Halsey made a decision late on the 24th of October that for a number of factors, he was going to take the entire Third Fleet and not leave a single ship to look at San Bernardino Strait, which gave Creed the chance to come through the Strait and therefore head south. So, but for a number of reasons, first of all, how the battle developed. There was a series of attacks the day before on the Kurita force, and Halsey thought that his aviators had crippled the Kurita force. Also, there were his orders from Nimitz that if he has the opportunity to attack the Japanese fleet, the main Japanese fleet, that that becomes his primary objective. And there's doctrine that you don't split your force in the face of the enemy. That's the worst possible thing. And the doctrine that the Japanese carrier force was the biggest threat and had been the biggest threat to American operations throughout the entire war. So when it shows up, here's the chance to knock it out. We did a little bit of that in June 1944, but here's a chance to finish the job. And there's Halsey's mindset. He's very aggressive, and he started the war as the senior American carrier commander, and he was never able to fight a carrier battle. He missed Coral Sea by a couple of days. He missed Midway because he had a skin condition, so that's when Spruance took over in his place. And he wasn't at the Battle of Philippine Sea. So there was no doubt what he was going to do. It was preordained that he was going to take his carrier force and go after the Japanese carrier force when he found it late on the 24th of October.
Hmm. A last matter I want to touch on briefly. This is Admiral Kurita, and he is sometimes criticized for not trying to attack and wipe out the so-called Taffy 3 kind of escort fleet when he supposedly had the chance. In your view, he acted out of conscience, in your words, by deciding not to throw away the lives of his men. In other words, he realized the ultimate futility of such a gesture. That says a lot about him, doesn't it?
Right, and only in the Imperial Navy can you condemn an admiral for not dying and taking 15,000 men with him. So he did act out of conscience, and he had a long combat record during the war. But he also showed during the war that he was concerned about his men and their welfare. And even in the Imperial Navy, you don't sign a suicide pact when you're given a set of orders to carry out that you know is going to result in the death of your force and yourself. And that didn't concern him. Dying for the emperor was fine, but it had to be with a purpose. And he knew that if he shows up off Leyte 5 days after the invasion, that all he's going to find in the Gulf is empty transports. And that was essentially correct. So his death would be for no reason. And he feared if he did that, he would be trapped by an array of American forces coming to the rescue of Taffy 3 and the shipping in the Gulf. So he made the decision not to do this, and I think it was the only honorable alternative given where he sat at that point.
Hmm. Again, I so appreciate the fact that you have treated with complete respect and understanding both sides of this conflict and both sides of this decisive battle. The book again is titled Leyte Gulf, A New History of the World's Largest Sea Battle, one of the most decisive events of the Second World War. This book is published by Osprey Publishing and the author, Mark Stille. Mark Stille, congratulations on a complicated job. Very, very well done. Thank you for this book, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you about it on The Morning Show.
Greg, you read the book. I mean, those were great questions, and it was a great interview. Thanks for taking the time to do it. Thanks for reading the book. You did a good job.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm excited to share this with our listeners. We'll be right back.
It is 9 o'clock. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.